welcome to another episode of the Albion Raw here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and we are nervously looking over our shoulders, again, in association with OldFootballShirts.com. Yes, that's right, we're right back in it again, after being outfoxed by Leicester at the Amex last week. It all started well with Adam Lallana netting his first goal for the club, but a lacklustre second half display allowed Leicester to return home with a point as another late goal undid us. So, only goal difference keeps us above the dreaded dotted line as we head to Southampton tomorrow lunchtime. Hopefully, Man City can do us a favour when they go to Fulham today. One player who will not be assisting us in our quest to stay up is Tarik Lamptey, who's now joined Solly March in being out for the rest of the season. Joining me today as we, try and avoid talking about all of that, is, of course, Alan Wares. And we will also hear from Polly Bancroft, who's the general manager of the Albion Women and Girls, and also from Joe Bacon from St Barnabas Hospice. But Al...
echo, rinse and repeat. How many times have we talked about this on the show? To be fair, actually, the difference this time is that we didn't boss the game in the way that we have been doing so many times. I mean, the amount of times that we've bossed the game is one thing. And we did probably do it against Leicester. You would never know that Leicester were third in the table. Although, didn't one or two people mention they might have had an injury or two?
Yeah, they had a massive injury list. A lot of their most influential players were missing.
I'll spare the commentary, the TV commentary of them mentioning it every 5 minutes, apparently, so by virtue of being there. So I couldn't hear the commentator.
To be honest, Al, that doesn't normally make any difference because you can normally hear them right behind you. The daggers I shoot up towards that general direction and fingers wagged.
Oh yeah, it's they do appeal to the lowest common denominator, don't they? We played really well in the first half and bettered Leicester, and the 1-0 lead was deserved and justified. Should we have gone in 2-0 up? Could we have? Did we deserve to? We had a chance or two, but 1-0 up against Leicester, while it's never going to be enough, is actually a good scoreline. It's a team in third place. Should we have gone in 2 or 3 up?
Not really.
Not necessarily.
And we're going to talk about Bob Sanchez's mistake at the end, but we should also talk about the fact that absolute stunning save he made in the first half.
Well, therein lies another point about, you know, from the show that we had last week with Shannon Ruth talking about the growth, the exponential growth of Robert Sanchez. And like I say, it was kind of a weird thing that we assumed that he was in the fourth place in the pecking order to replace Matty Ryan. As to why Ryan was dropped to the bench is another matter. And I don't suppose it was any one particular thing. It's just I think obviously Potter wanted a replacement. Sanchez has certainly proved his worth. Mm. How many games has he played for us? What, 12, 15, something like that?
I think it's 14.
So you expect a dropsy or a flap, everything. You know, every now and again, it happens. It's just that, you know, any time you're going to make a flap or a dropsy, not in the, you know, in the last minute when the team, you know, that's in the third place in the Premier League can then capitalise on it. You know, make sure you do it when no one else is in the area or you know, whatever it is. But as for that save, yeah, I mean, it was leathered. You know, it was direct, it was true. It wasn't quite in the top corner as much as I thought it was. If you remember Ryan's save at Southampton last year, but he really leathered it. And when I was watching it in real time, boy, did that ball shit. Yeah. I mean, it really belted it.
It was that was his 16th appearance, I've just checked.
Okay.
He's goalkeepers, when they make mistakes, it's largely amplified because it usually ends up in a goal. So, he's been coming out and claiming those, and that's one of the reasons why he's been given the shirt, because he is that dominant in the box. And it's, you know, I'm not going to blame him too much for it because he missed.
It's a choice. It's a decision that he's taken. He wants to take responsibility for it. I don't think it was particularly the wrong choice. It's just he made a mess of it. If it was one of those where, you know, you could see he had absolutely no chance of getting it, then you think, okay, well then back to the training ground for you, Sunshine, and let's see what we can work on. But I think this is just one of those, he just misjudged. You then also do have to ask questions about the rest of the marking, because, you know, the scorer was on his own at the back post.
Mm.
So where was everyone else doing their job? But in the great scheme of things, listen, Bob Sanchez, way into the plus column with us still at the moment.
Absolutely. And long may that continue, actually, because, you know, I mean, like I said, I mean, he is dominant. I like a goalkeeper to be dominant in the box.
For God's sake, you know, goalkeepers don't hit their peak till they're 30. You know, I've got high hopes for him. I mean, I've not known a keeper so young, so unknown to us, just hit the ground running in such a way. And let's face it, in the Premier League. Now, we've been watching the Albion for 40 years, the pair of us, of which this is what our eighth season we've seen us in the top division. You have to bear in mind who they're playing against. And this is a 23-year-old who's come in, dropped at the deep end, playing against Spurs. Couldn't really fault him for either goal. But the way he comes in and claims that, you know, it's like that last-minute claim from a corner at Anfield. You know, we're all, oh, don't get me wrong, since what's happened at Anfield is another matter, but we didn't know that was going to be the case.
Yeah.
He comes in, wipes out the entire defence, claiming the ball. That's the sort of thing you want. You were critical of Matty Ryan not doing that, and that bit I get, and it left too much on the defence to do. But when you've got a keeper who is going to do that, then yes, it does actually lend an extra string to the bow, and brilliant.
Like I said, I'm not going to be critical of him for it, because, you know, it's something that happens to all goalkeepers. They quite often come out and, you know, majority of the time they will claim it, and this time it didn't. But okay, well, we did open the scoring, and it was Adam Lallana's first goal for the club. It's been a long time coming. In fact, well, there's a few chances he's had where he's blazed it over.
Well, the blazing over bit is very much a Brighton DNA thing, but he did actually, that was a very cool finish. It's the sort of finish that you'd like to think any one of our strikers should know how to do. When in the one-on-one situation, and it was a one-on-one, if those one-on-one situations that our young strikers want to learn how to do it, you know, if it's given the eyes, pass it the other way, put it in the net, that's how you do it. And those strikers do know how to do it. They just haven't. They panic, they flap, they, you know, internally they scream. And into row Z it goes. So, yeah, great finish. Yeah. But let's face it, the sort of finish at this level you really should be expecting.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we don't want to talk about it too much, Al. But, I mean, we're now bang in trouble.
We've been here before. In fact, it was probably worse a couple of years ago.
I mean, this is a big if, because Fulham are playing Man City at home today. And Man City, who swept aside this weekend's opponent, Southampton, 5-2 midweek. So, you know...
There's ifs everywhere, mate. Yeah, Fulham could...
But, I mean,
yeah, of course Fulham could pull off the shot, but therein lies the point. You know, it's not worth worrying about until it happens, you know. Yeah, we're nervous. Yeah, we should be... We're in a position we really, really shouldn't be. And there is an interesting tweet that's been put out this week by someone neutral about, you know, the amount of, sort of blatant misses.
The missed chances, yeah.
Graham Potter has been let down, and I can get the point, and I hope, you know, if the players see that, they'll actually buck up and embarrassed that they are so horrific. You know, we shouldn't be in this position. So if they actually just do what they should do, we ought to get out of it comfortably. I know I've been saying this for a long time, but at the end of the day, if people say, oh, are we too good to go down? If we go down, then the answer is no, you know, no, we're not too good to go down, because we couldn't prove it, you know. And at the end of the season, you know, I know it's an old cliche, but the table doesn't lie, but we're still a quarter of the season to go. So let's not get too flappy about it.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, that show wheel of missed chances, hopefully that will get shown to the players and say, look.
I'm sure they know themselves, mate. I reckon they do.
Well, I know, but it's just frustrating. I mean, I'm getting incredibly frustrated about it. I know that a lot of the... You can't blame the manager, because the chances are being created. And if the players simply aren't good enough to put the ball in the back of the net. I mean, I think it is...
AD, they are good enough. That's the point. They are good enough.
Has it become an albatross?
Well, if they come onto the pitch worrying about it, then they shouldn't be on the pitch.
Maybe. Okay. Okay. Well, Southampton, we go. Nice to be live on BBC One.
I'm just setting my money. If I had a mortgage, which I don't, but if I did, I'll bet you whatever it is you like, Southampton will get a Moody penalty just because they do.
Well, we do owe them a couple. I don't know who the ref is on Sunday.
Mate, if it was down to us owing, us being owed, down to Moody penalties, we need to beat them 6-0 with six penalties. But let's face it, even then, if we got a penalty, seven of them would be missed.
Well, Kelvin Morton wasn't the ref at Selhurst this season when Tarek Lamptey gave away a penalty, allegedly. Another Moody one out. But Tarek has now joined Solly March as being a wing-back on the physio's table. And that's a big miss for us. I mean, Veltman's come in and done tremendously well.
But that's the weird thing, isn't it? He's played, what, 9 games for us this season? 10 games, something like that. I'm sure you've got the stats to hand. But that's the weird thing is, yes, when we saw him play, and at times it was absolutely scintillating, it was like watching Vicente, it was like watching Kazenga Lualua, it was like watching Anthony Knockhart, albeit from fullback. And because we weren't expecting it was fantastic to watch. But as fullbacks go, it's not as though I'm trying to dismiss Tarek Lamptey, far from it. Joel Veltman is a perfectly good fullback, and for me, is still the first choice right fullback / right wingback. Tarek Lamptey, having said that, his potential is astronomical. It's brilliant, and he is a fun player to watch. Yes, we have missed him, especially when we've needed that extra little bit, that extra sort of creativity. But therein lies the stuff. Is it growing pains? I mean, you know, he's what, 21 years old, but you know, has he finished growing? I'm sure he must have done, but yes, it's a shame. He will come back hopefully stronger. I fundamentally disagree with the Brighton fan, and I use the word in very, very loose terms, who feels that the entire medical backroom staff should be sacked for not actually looking after him properly. May give your head a wobble. So next season, whatever division we're in, really looking forward to seeing Tarek Lamptey bursting up and down the wing, which reminds me, I cannot see him moving. If he stays or whether he goes, he's still not proven himself because he's played 9 games. He's a prospect, but let's face it, he's also a sick note. So, you know, every team that is going to be interested in him, it comes with a caveat emptor.
Yeah, it's just one of those things where he needs to be carefully managed. I do disagree with the fact that if the worst does happen and we don't get to break our record. I mean, last time we were in the top flight, we only stayed for 4 seasons. Let's hope we can extend it to 5 this time. But if we do fulfil the trapdoor, Tarek won't be here. Someone. A bigger fish will come in because basically he has got that much potential to be playing at the highest level.
But who is going to, okay, let's put it this way. Who is going to, all right, not necessarily the club itself, but what kind of club is going to offer the kind of money that the club will want for Tarek Lamptey? Now, I appreciate there's a different figure if we're in the Premier League compared to being in the Championship, but someone like Tarek Lamptey would be the perfect foil for catapulting this club back up to the Premier League. And so therefore his value to the club is going to put off other clubs, especially those who know he's only played 9 games.
I don't think it really works that. It doesn't really work that way anymore, Al. But I mean, there's it's not just this country that clubs are looking at him as a potential. Certainly a lot of clubs in Germany and around the world would be, and in Spain would be absolutely delighted to have him in their ranks, as would we, and we're not in that position yet. And hopefully Tarek Lamptey will be playing Premier League football for the Albion next season. Okay, so earlier this week, it was International Women's Day, and Al caught up with Polly Bancroft, who is the general manager of the Albion women's and girls teams.
Polly, how are you? Welcome back.
I'm doing very well, thanks, Alan, particularly after our strong result yesterday in the league. So, yeah, doing really well. And thanks for having me back.
No, not at all. Thanks for coming back on. So for those that missed the podcast in back in November, just give us a brief outline as to who you are and what the role of a general manager does.
Thanks, Alan. Yeah, so I see all oversee all operational duties of women's football at the club. So looking at ways in which we can integrate women's football into the overarching club, thinking about a strategic approach for the women's game. So trying to learn from some of the areas that the men do, within the Premier League setup, and apply that to the women's team as well. So really just trying to provide as much sort of off-field business support to Hope and the rest of the team to make sure that we're in as best position as possible to be competing on the field.
Well, give us a for instance as to what were you talking about, sort of taking ideas from the men's game. Is there a specific instance you could give us?
Yeah, sure. So the Premier League are very good at providing various packages of support for the men's first team and the academy. So whether that's educational courses, nutrition, there's a very good transport system in place to try and assist players who might not have the means to get to training. So it's trying to learn from some of the existing operations that the men's side of the club have in place and trying to spot the need and the opportunity to integrate that into the women and girls side of the programme.
Got you. Now, over these past few months, for anyone who does have a reason to go past it, they probably see the bulldozers at the training centre. So can you give us an update as to, because we know that there's going to be extensions for all aspects of the club, but give us an update as to where you're at with how the Elite Performance Centre is being expanded.
Yeah, so that's a multi-million pound investment going into a dedicated building at the training ground in Lancing. So we're really excited to be in there sort of mid to late summer. So we keep popping in and seeing how the building's progressing and the foundations are going down and the walls are coming up and all of those things. So more and more people with hard hats on, the better. We've also started to look into, a lot of the detail internally. So the meeting room spaces. We're currently thinking about the artwork and quotes and things to go on the wall. So, yeah, it's all starting to become nice and real, which is very exciting.
So when you're talking about the artwork and things like that, so it's not just necessarily football quotes. I guess there'll be sort of, women in history who you might want to sort of consider putting up there, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. And also, thinking about our identity and the values of the club. And how we bring that to the fore throughout the pathway. So, from our under 11s all the way through to the women's first team, to make sure that we're celebrating the past and also knowing, who we are as a team right now and what we can do to perform the best on the pitch each weekend.
Because when you're talking about sort of these things being built, I mean, it's indicative of the club's, you say multi-million pound, but certainly it's indicative of the club's intention for the progression of the women's and the girls' game, isn't it?
Oh, it's huge. And, we're really hoping that facility will play an integral part in terms of, retaining the excellent players that we've got in the first team, but also recruiting new ones as well. So when they see the investment that's going into women's football, from the training ground into the first team and some of the provision that we give to the players, whether that's medical support or in terms of a Marcom's perspective, the investment is solid, and particularly, throughout a pandemic, to continue that support structurally, is huge. So, yeah, we think by the time it'll open, it'll be the best facility for women and girls football in the country. So it's quite something to be proud about and certainly to be shouting about as well.
Absolutely. I mean, when you're talking about the pandemic now, the light at the end, the very least, the light switch at the end of the tunnel has been found, maybe to turn it on. And there's obviously talk about people going back to see at least one Premier League game before the end of the season. Now, is that going to be the case for the women's team, or is the season going to finish before the intended sort of release of lockdown? Do you know?
Yeah, unfortunately, at the moment, our last fixture is on the 9th of May, whereas the restrictions lift a week or so after that. So we're just shy, unfortunately. We're still in negotiations with the FA about the Women's FA Cup and the continuation of that competition this season, or whether some of those fixtures move into next season. But we're doing an awful lot of planning to make sure that our matches are communicated and advertised to as many people as possible. So as soon as the gates can be opened again, that we're getting bumper crowds in week out.
Because we're getting news, I mean, you know, reading various aspects of the press and not sort of like the press that you ideally want to ignore, is that the Premier League is looking to see if they can move a couple of the Premier League weekends to after that 17th of May opening up date. And it looks on paper a sort of fairly reasonable request. Is there anything within the women's game, within the women's Super League, that says, well, can we put our last fixture back a week, thereby allowing people into the women's game? Is there anything that you know of that's happening down that road?
I think the complexity within the women's game is because many teams play at, say, in quotes, men's stadia. So obviously with the women's first team, we play at Crawley Town. Hmm. Crawley Town men have their last game on the 8th of May. Brighton women have their last game on the 9th of May. And their pitch refurbishments are looking to start on the 10th of May. So unfortunately, because we don't own our own stadium, it's not quite as simple as trying to, you know, extend the season by a couple of weeks. And we're not the only club in that position. So there's only really Man City, potentially Chelsea, Reading, who could afford that luxury of, you know, changing the dates of the season. So, yeah, there's a few other things at play in the women's game, unfortunately.
Sure. But, OK, so talking about the current season, the Albion women are a little bit of a roll. I mean, it must be exciting times in the camp at the moment.
Oh, huge buzz in the office this morning, which was great. And, you know, we were sharing on the group chat yesterday as well. So, no, it's great. And to, yeah, our third successive win in the Super League. So it's the first time we've achieved that. So we're absolutely delighted. And the players have, you know, fully deserve all the plaudits that they're getting at the moment. So they played really well.
And you should never sort of contemplate until it's as Lenny Kravitz said, it ain't over till it's over. But this must go a long, long way to retaining your Women's Super League status for next season.
Oh, absolutely. And certainly the gap in the table is much closer looking upwards than it is downwards. So I think there's 6 points between us in seventh and Tottenham in eighth, whereas only 2 points to move into sixth. So, you know, it's certainly a nice position to be in terms of looking up in the table rather than down.
So what's changed in these last three games? I mean, the men's team went on a little bit of a buzz and we realised actually all things are coming together. I mean, is that what's happened this time, that Hope has got the team facing the same way and they're buzzing in the same way?
Yeah, I think there was a bit of a reset sort of at back end of February when we'd had a couple of difficult results, you know, to really self-reflect, you know, have a think about what we want to achieve as a team. So I think that that reset, you know, for staff and for players to really have a think about, you know, what's gone wrong, what can we address to change in the future. And I think that's really stood us in good stead to get those three wins most recently.
I was about to say, I mean, it's not as though we're going to actually sort of indulge any finger pointing here, but that was a huge 180 between a kind of an unexpected defeat and a not particularly sort of pleasant one to watch either against Bristol City. And then there's even more unexpected win against Chelsea. So there's resets and then there's, you know, that sounded like a complete start again. What happened in that week?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, meetings internally, you know, discussions, you know, getting some thoughts out on the table, clearing the air, those kinds of things. But I think throughout the season, we've done a little bit better when we've been the underdog. So when we've come up against Arsenal and Chelsea previously, like we only lost 1-0 to Chelsea before Christmas. So that was a really close game as well. So I think an element of when the pressure's off, we'd perform better. And then when we're expected to win games against Bristol and West Ham and Aston Villa, we haven't performed as well. So there's an element of trying to work out why that was happening and put that to bed as well.
Perhaps Graham Potter should have actually joined that meeting as well. So in the great scheme of things, we'll come on to sort of the International Women's Day aspect of it in a minute, but there is something big bumping down the pipeline for next year. I think the countdown started 500 days to go. So tell us how the Albion are involved on a Europe-wide scale.
Yeah, so next year we're hosting 3 matches of the Women's Euro. So we're really excited to be a host city. So we're really working with the council, local authorities to put on a big show and welcome lots of visitors and people already living within the area to the Amex to watch elite national team women's football. So, yeah, really exciting time for the club. And obviously we're really hopeful that some of those that are enthused by international football stay on and come and support the women's team up at Crawley as well.
Now, I don't know if it's anything that you can answer, but I think prior to lockdown, it appeared that the draw had already been made, or a sense of a draw had been made. And it looked like that the Albion would definitely host in England in one, if not two games. And when I look at the UEFA website now, has that draw been kind of done away with? Or do you know what's happened there? Because I can't see anything that denotes any fixtures.
Yeah, so I think there's only 13 or so teams qualified. There's still some playoffs to take place as well. So in terms of the makeup of the teams participating in that tournament, there were matches due to be scheduled in the last year, which obviously didn't take place because of the pandemic. So, we're still waiting to see which teams we'll host at the Amex. Obviously, we'd love an England match here. That would be really exciting. Mm-hmm. We're just waiting to see which of the final teams will be.
Now, there's one thing I have done, and I don't know if the club are actually going to sort of start promoting it, but I've actually already registered for tickets, which you do on the UEFA website. Is there anything that you can tell us that if we're interested in going, we can do? Is there anything that the club is offering, or is that something that's going to happen later down the line?
Yeah, and registering for tickets is exactly the right thing to do. I would hate for people to miss out. So I'd really encourage people to register for tickets as early as possible. I don't know if you had this challenge, but I remember watching the 2012 Olympics and I thought, oh, I'm not going to register early. Like, I'll just pick up some tickets as and when. And I totally missed out. And then I'm sat there watching the opening ceremony thinking, oh, God, I really should have done that. So I wouldn't want anybody to feel how I felt missing out on 2012. So, yeah, I think register your interest. You can always change your plans later down the line, but, you know, it's free to register your interest. And, you know, if you've got to put your name in the hat, right?
Absolutely. Well, I've already registered for the Amex and for Brentford's new ground as well. So I'd be quite excited if I got tickets for that as well. But, you know, we know that the Albion, almost without trying, I won't say without trying, it's probably a little unfair, but we know that the Albion can host, you know, minimum 20,000 for an England game, and that's just for a friendly.
Mm-hmm. And the Rugby World Cup was hosted here as well. So, yeah, it's an excellent stadium that can turn its hand to various different events. And, yeah, I know, having been involved in some of the planning meetings with UEFA, they're really pleased with the quality of the facilities that we've got here. So, looking forward to welcoming people to town.
Absolutely. So here we are on International Women's Day. Obviously, you're very busy. Well, you're always very busy, but I know you've been doing a lot of press stuff. But give us a flavour of if there is a kind of an average day-to-day thing that you do, and just let us know how you feel the state of women's football at Brighton and Hove Albion is right now.
Yeah, it's really positive time for the women's game. I've been in post 5 months now, and I think one of the things I've enjoyed most is that openness from colleagues to learn more about the women's programme, learn more about the unique differences that there might be with women and girls compared to men and boys. So I've conducted a SWOT analysis over the 5 months just to try and work out what challenges there might be, either from previous or, you know, just from current state, and trying to spot some opportunities to better develop and integrate the women's program into the men's club. So it's
did you come up with any weaknesses and threats?
It's the women's game is always going to be playing catch up a little bit to the men's game, but I just keep seeing plenty of opportunities and enthusiasm from within the club to keep doing more and keep doing better. So within my time, we've launched an Instagram account. So we're trying to raise the profile of women's football on that platform. We're growing the Twitter account and followers there as well. So trying to create some engaging content for those two platforms. Also looking into the commercial makeup of the women's program, looking at our program, our match day programs, how we communicate to fans, also two-way communication as well. So setting up some surveys to hear from fans about, you know, what they'd like to see at women's matches. So a huge sort of scoping exercise in my first 5 months, which will then inform the content of my work over the coming years.
Got you. Now, it's fair to say that obviously football, you know, it's not only a game. For all those that don't like the sport, they say football's only a game. No, it's not. If it was only a game, people wouldn't get so wound up over it. And over the past century or so, it has been, you know, a force for political and social change. Now, you know, with the FA effectively banning women's football from 1921 to 1971, and the slow but now thankfully increasing awareness of the women's game, can I put it to you as to where you feel your weaknesses and threats are for not just your role but women's football generally? I mean, in terms of the social political considerations of, you know, I've got it from friends, women shouldn't be playing football, or women's football isn't as good. So how do you actually sort of cope on a day-to-day basis with knowing full well that that is still, on probably far too many levels, a heavy door that you're pushing, having to push against?
I would say to any doubter, you know, no one's trying to force women's football on you. You know, there might be supporters of the men's team who only want to support the men's team, and that's absolutely fine. What we're trying to do is to raise the profile of the women's team and the athletes that we have within the women's team for their own, you know, for their own merit. We know that, you know, we do a good job in terms of promoting the women's fixtures to the existing men's database. And we've got, you know, reasonable confidence that a supporter of the men's team will know quite a lot about the women's team, but, you know, they still may not choose to come and watch them. That's absolutely fine. So we're now trying to think about who our own target audience might be for the women's team. Now, the FA have given us some insight and said that typically men and women who play football once a week might be a good place for us to start targeting. You know, and that makes quite a lot of sense. If you're playing football, you're probably inclined to watch it as well. So we're trying to do some target marketing to try and work out how we can attract a new audience to Crawley Town to come and watch the women. So I suppose it's just not assuming that those that watch the men definitely want to come and watch the women, but identifying a new audience. And also knowing that, you know, some of the research that we have is that those that come and watch, they enjoy it and they come back again. But one of the biggest barriers is awareness. So not knowing about the team, not knowing where they play, not knowing which league they're in, not knowing how to buy tickets. So the biggest challenge we have is around awareness of information outside of the main club existing distribution list. So how do we tap into grassroots clubs and schools in the Crawley area? How do we expand, you know, our messaging outside of the club's existing databases? So it's not, from the insight that we have, it's not that people don't want to come, they're just not aware. And that's a lot easier to deal with than people who are aware but don't want to come.
Fair enough. And just to close off, we're talking about the fact that the Albion are playing at Crawley Town. Now, with obviously the Lancing being expanded, do you know if there's any, if their club is any further down the line to identifying a second mini stadium for either the under-23s or the women to play in closer to home? Because from my point of view, certainly, I still see that as not an insurmountable barrier, but a barrier nonetheless. So, you know, is there somewhere close to Brighton that's been identified, do you know?
Not that I'm aware of at this stage. I think, you know, it would be really nice to have at some point. We're certainly committed to Crawley for the next three seasons. So we're trying to bed down there a little bit more. And, you know, it's a good size stadium. The pitch surface is excellent. So, you know, there are a lot of positives about playing at Crawley. I mean, you know, travel time is quite subjective, so it depends on your availability or means of transport to get there. I mean, of course, having, you know, a bespoke stadium that's in blue closer to the Amex or closer to Brighton and Hove sort of city areas would be, you know, a lot better rather than, you know, a blue team playing in a red stadium.
Ever pull out, then, you know, I'm sure there's space there. No, that's not going down that road.
But again, it's, you know, part of the bigger picture of women's football. There's only Man City and Chelsea that got bespoke grounds. Everybody else is, you know, sort of borrowing from a men's club. So, you know, I could see in the next 10 years or so that might be, you know, firmly on the table, but no one predicted a pandemic. No one predicted, you know, significant losses of money that have, that Tony Bloom's had to meet, you know, particularly this season. So I think any maybe shorter or medium term plans are probably a bit further along the line now.
Great stuff. Any final thoughts you've got, Polly, on encouraging people to come and support the women's team?
Yeah, I mean, all support is very well received. I think we've got about six games left in the league. Everyone can watch all matches free to air on the FA Player. I think we'll be streaming one on the club website as well. So, you know, please get involved. Please follow on the social media accounts. So it's BHAFC Women on Twitter and Instagram. And yeah, all the matches free to watch. So keep your support and engagement coming.
You are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. This show is, as ever, brought to you in association with oldfootballshirts.com. More news about them later. But Al, Phil has given us a shirt to have a look at. So what can you tell me about this particular jersey?
If I was ever designing a supermarket can of baked beans, this would be one of the designs I consider. Okay, what we're looking at here is a kind of a red, orange, and sort of burnt yellow shirt. It's a t-shirt with white trim, collar and cuff trim, with zigzag patterns that go between this kind of burnt yellow and orange. I say very big beanie. You think Roger Daltrey on the Who sellout. There's a badge that says Oaksmith Gold Glasses. When I sing old Oaksmith Gold, it looks like a beer, but clearly not. There's I assume the shirt manufacturer is Deltin. There's a couple of shirt sleeve badges, which I can't see. It's also quite tricky to read who the sponsor is. It looks like something like Indie News or something like that, which I don't know if that means that they're sponsored by a corner shop or something. And the badge looks like a kind of an Oxford United badge, but I think Phil's mucked about with the badge. It's hard to say. I'm going to take a wild punt in the dark and say that this is an Indian shirt, maybe even the one worn by Calde. So that would be Chennai. How far out am I?
You are certainly in the right country, Al. That is a good guess, actually. It's kind of Charlie Brown, but in different colours.
It's a nice T-shirt, but it's not a nice football shirt.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, this is what Phil from oldfootballshirts.com has to say about this shirt. He says this is the current home shirt of the Indian Super League side, FC Goa. They're nicknamed the Goas, and they play at the 19,000 capacity Fatorda Stadium, which is in Margao, which is the capital of the state of Goa. The club was formed in 2014, shortly after the Indian Super League was formed, and Goa's first manager was none other than Brazilian legend Zico. And their first marquee player was former Arsenal player Robert Pires. The club's ownership includes Indian cricket ace Virat Kohli and is backed by billionaire tech businessman Venugopal Dutt. This heavyweight backing has allowed the club to recruit stone squads year on year, culminating in winning the league title last year and the Indian Super Cup in 2019. Interest in the league is big in Goa, with every home match pretty much sold out since 2014. And plans in the not too distant future is to move to a bigger stadium. The current club squad includes five former La Liga players with Spanish manager Juan Ferrando. In the past, Brazilian internationals André Santos and Lucio have starred alongside another dozen or so Brazilian players, and the Zico influence continues. Links to the UK include the aforementioned Robert Pires, but I also found Scottish journeyman Daryl Duffy of Hull, Swansea and Bristol Rovers, amongst many others. And yes, there is a link to the Albion. Striker Adrian Colunga made 17 league appearances for the Seagulls in 2014 to 2015. Finished his career playing for FC Goa, playing a handful of games in 2018. I quite like Adrian Kulunga. I know he's a bit of a mad...
Well, it was just a part of Sammy Hupia's entourage, and so it's kind of been tainted by that. I mean, there's a lot of things that are tainted by that. You know, it was kind of a season to forget almost, wasn't it?
Pretty much. I've forgotten most of it, to be honest. Yeah. I can remember Rowan Ince's goal at Swindon. That was good.
And the win at Leeds.
And Chris Hughton coming in.
That's about it. Now, for those of you who have been listening to The Raw, well, we'd like to think over the last 14 years, but certainly over the last couple of weeks, you know that we've been auctioning a very rare red away shirt. It was worn most famously away at Peterborough in that snowbound game back in 1986. We worked out that it was only played in about half a dozen games, but we've managed to auction the Justin Fashanu shirt, of which we know that a third of the proceeds went to Cancer Research UK, a third went to the Brighton Food Bank, and a third went to St Barnabas Hospice. And I'm now joined by Joe Bacon from St Barnabas Hospice. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
Welcome to the Albion Raw. So before we talk about what it is that we've done, tell us about you, your job, and a bit about St Barnabas Hospice.
Yeah, sure. So I look after kind of corporate partnerships at the hospice. So St Barnabas House has been providing hospice care for local people and their families in Worthing and surrounding areas for over 45 years now. And we really strongly believe that everyone facing life-limiting illness should receive the care and support that they deserve. And that extends to the whole family, not just the patient. So we have a 20-bed inpatient unit and a day hospice. And we also have an incredible team of community nurses who actually go out and provide care in people's own homes. And we also provide rehabilitation services like physiotherapy and family and bereavement support as well. And patients and families aren't actually charged for the care that they receive from us. And it actually costs nearly £9 million to provide all of our services. And only a small proportion of that is covered by statutory funding. So for the rest of it, we rely on the generosity and support of the local community and people like yourselves.
Well, let's put our donation into context, doesn't it? £9 million. What will £9 million get? I mean, how many people does that, and I am going to use the wrong words compared to what the words I should use, but how many people does that look after?
So the figures change each year. So last year we cared for about 1,800 patients. And of course that care is extended onto kind of looking after their loved ones as well. So with all the aftercare, the counselling, bereavement support. So it is such an important service. And with the impact of COVID-19, we've cared for so many more patients. And we've seen, you know, a 50% increase in some of the services that we've been providing.
I was about to say, how has the pandemic affected you? I mean, we're hearing stories, you know, from up and down the country about how care homes and hospices are looking after people and are being hit. I mean, tell us St Barnabas's story of how the pandemic has hit.
Yeah, so of course it's been such a challenging time for everyone, and our care teams have been so amazing. You know, they've worked so hard. You know, we've had to adapt some of our services. We've actually added new beds into our inpatient unit to help meet the demand. And actually we've seen a 50% increase in those who we're caring for in their own homes. It's so important that people have a choice when it comes to receiving end of life care where they want to be, and helping people to stay at home to be with their loved ones has been such a huge part of our journey of caring during the pandemic, because of course in hospital settings and things and at the inpatient unit at the hospice, restrictions have had to be limited of course because of the virus. So you know, it's been so important to be able to provide that care still. And then, of course, with all of that going on, our fundraising income has fallen dramatically with fundraising events cancelled, our shops being closed, you know, the support that we've had from our local community has been outstanding. But it's important for people to know that, you know, that we still need that support so that we can continue providing the vital care that people need.
Because the big bashes that you have, I mean, is you've got a kind of a sister hospice, if you can call it that, in Chestnut Tree House, don't you? Mm-hmm. I mean, the work that you do, is it for both of them, or are you specifically at St Barnabas?
So I'm specifically at St Barnabas, which cares for adults with life-limiting illnesses, and then Chestnut Tree House cares for children with life-limiting illnesses. And actually, when we were at the height of the pandemic, our Chestnut Tree House nurses, some of them came over to St Barnabas House to help our nurses because the demand was just so huge. So it really was a huge team effort.
Because the bit, and I say, some of the big bashes, I mean, I know that Chestnut Tree House, for instance, always has its Winter Wonderland ball at the end of December, which it had to cancel this year. I mean, what are the things that you've had to take away from your regular diary of fundraising events that and you know, is there scope to catch up on that?
Yeah, so I mean, for St Barnabas House, we have our flagship Midnight Walk, which, you know, I mean, basically all of our events that we had planned for last year were all cancelled. But you know, we're hoping, restrictions permitting, that we can really get going and with our events for this year. And we have actually introduced a new one. So
do tell. Here's your platform.
So we've got we've introduced wing walks and bungee jumps.
Oh dear God.
In addition to our normal ab sales. So we're super excited about those. You can hop onto our website and find out more about those. So we're very optimistic for the year ahead, and we're just really hoping that people will jump on board and support us.
Literally jump on board.
Yeah.
You do the most terrifying things to raise money, but you know, I suppose that life is there to be lived. So yeah, absolutely. So I mean, you mentioned the figure of £9 million to keep something like St Barnabas Hospice open and to provide the care that you do. So, you know, it kind of, we're very proud to be what we've done. We're not smashy and nice and want to keep our charity hidden. You know, we're proud of what we've done, but it's only £420. What kind of thing can that £420 do?
So it's so important to emphasise that every pound really does count for donations. Brilliant. You know, £9 million sounds very intimidating, but you know, if everyone thought that, then people just wouldn't donate, would they? So, mm-hmm. You know, it will make such a huge impact. So, for example, it could pay for a patient to spend time at the hospice, so they can provide help controlling their symptoms, improve their quality of life, or it could pay for a patient to be cared for overnight at home, so that gives their carers some much needed respite, or it could give bereaved relatives the support they need after the loss of a loved one. So it kind of puts that nicely into context, and you know, it really will make such a huge difference.
And moving forward, do you have I guess it's difficult for someone like myself who's not familiar with the nature of end of life care and palliative care. So I do apologise if I'm asking the wrong question, but how does, you know, given the lockdown hopefully ending soon, how does the future for St Barnabas Hospice look?
So we're actually seeing kind of the wider impacts of the pandemic now. So kind of from the end of last year, we're seeing an increase in people kind of coming under our care who are perhaps a bit younger than our average patient. And that's because they've missed crucial diagnosis because of the pandemic. So we are, you know, we're not out of the woods yet. I think, you know, we'll be seeing a lot of people in similar situations going forward. So, you know, our care services are still so vital, and in fact more vital than ever. So it's really important to still have that support so that we can ensure that people get the care that they need and deserve.
I guess that's something I hadn't really considered, that NHS services being stretched to the point they have, that the diagnoses got missed. And it's tricky to know how to put into words. I mean, as someone who works in that aspect of it and someone here who really doesn't, it's a head scratcher as to how, we're moving forwards with, an entire year of potential diagnoses being missed. Mm-hmm. And that then puts a further strain on someone like yourself, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But we've got such amazing care teams that just provide the most tender, loving care that you could possibly imagine. So, that's what hospices are there for. And we're very lucky in Worthing that we have this hospice, and that we have so many wonderful people that do support us.
So going forward, like you said, as you mentioned just now, hopefully, the light at the end of the tunnel is being switched back on, and lockdown is being eased, and we can return to some semblance of normality, whatever form normality will take. So hopefully with that, obviously, events will kick in both yourselves and Chestnut Tree can start raising funds again. But if anyone does want to get involved on the back of what you're saying here, how can they do that?
Yeah, so whether anyone wants to fundraise for us, take on a challenge, leave a gift in your will, volunteer, or just make a donation, there's so many different ways that you can get involved. You can find out all about that on our website, which is www.stbh.org.uk.
One more time.
www.stbh.org.uk. And I just want to say a massive thank you to the Albion Roar and to Phil at oldfootballshirts.com. You may think it's a small donation, but it really does mean so much and will make such a huge difference. So thank you so, so much.
Our pleasure.
And she most certainly is welcome, as are the other two charities, the Brighton Food Bank and Cancer Research UK. I'm absolutely astonished with that figure.
It's incredible, isn't it? I mean, we were watching the countdown tick by, and we were kind of warned by Phil, who knows about this sort of thing, about this thing called sniping or snipering.
Yeah.
And it had been a very hefty amount, beforehand. So we were it was good that there was two people who specifically wanted it. So there we were, down to the last 10 seconds, and it went from 1,040 to 1,470 in about 4 seconds.
Well, that's the thing, because it went up to 1,060 for about 2 seconds, and then it went to 1,470.
Well, I think that was its first thing. It was one person had actually put in a bid for it to go in with 4 seconds to go. So it went bang, 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 and that's it, 4 seconds, over.
It's
not an uncommon thing, apparently, amongst serious eBayers. Yeah. So, it's a different world out there.
It looks like it went to a Brighton fan. So, good. So, congratulations if you're listening.
And thank you to everyone who
did. And it was absolutely great. So, okay, so this Sunday, the brand new Peter James series Grace premieres on ITV. And we caught up with Peter just after filming wrapped. And this is what he had to say.
And I've been out in the police now for, God, over 30 years, and I've met countless homicide detectives, both in this country and abroad. And the one thing that a good homicide detective has is empathy. They are a really good detective, a major crime detective, has a combination of two kind of quite unusual, quite opposing characteristic traits. You don't normally get these in one person. The first characteristic is they're incredibly anal, because every major crime is a huge puzzle. Hundreds, if not thousands, of little pieces have to be painstakingly, very boringly put together. But the really good detectives actually have a creative side to them. They're real blue sky thinkers. And that's what Roy Grace has. And that's what John has, and he portrays that so well. And the other really important thing for a murder detective is the ability to bond with the victim's loved ones and family. They tend to be, rather than shouty, angry, belligerent people, they tend to be very calm, quiet people who will bond with the family, because they'll get more out of the family that way. Apart from obviously giving them comfort, they'll learn stuff. And John's got that to a T. You know, I think and Laura, my wife, we get the weekly assemblies of the sort of very rough cut of every week's footage sent. And she said, you know, he talks like a cop and you actually believe him. And what's also really critical to me to the series working is the chemistry between John and John Sim and Glenn Branson, Richie Campbell. And John said to me, he said, you know, I said, it looks, last time we spoke, I said, it looks to me like you really get on well. He said, not only are we getting on screen, we're getting on really well off screen.
Brilliant.
And John emailed me today and he just said, look, I'm really sorry we finished. I said, I've never said that before. I've never had such a good time in production.
Okay, well, you mentioned Russell Lewis there, who's adapted the books for these first two shows. How much creative license has he been allowed?
Completely. It is, the great thing is that he's been incredibly respectful. So every change he's made, he's asked if I'm happy with all the way down the line. And we've discussed and we've worked through and he's listened also to Dave Gaylor and made changes resulting in getting the, where he's tried to ride roughshod for good dramatic reasons over certain police procedural aspects or change them. He's listened to Dave and there's been some really good compromises. He's been, I've never had a happy relationship working with a writer.
Oh, fantastic.
So in the great scheme of things then, Peter, I mean, we'll talk about the casting in a second with the rest of the cast and how Aidy managed to miss out on Cassian Pugh once again.
He would have been great.
He would have been. Is in the great scheme of things, with all the work that all the production companies and the things that you were talking about over the years and the grief that you've had to put up with effectively your baby here, are you happy with what's been produced?
I am I'm over the moon, genuinely. I could not be happier. I feel very, very lucky that what I think we've got is something really, really strong that I think all fans of Roy Grace are going to love. And I think everyone who doesn't know Roy Grace is just going to enjoy as a really great crime series. I genuinely say that. I think that the directors have done a fantastic job. We've had a wonderful producer, Kieran Murray-Smith, who he lives in Saltdean. You know, he loves Brighton and Hove. So what he's done is he's imbued Brighton into the filming. You know, you need somebody who knows a city.
Because you want to be shown, I mean, the cinematographer's got to really want to show the best side of the city, doesn't it? I mean, obviously...
Aidy, sorry, I've got to cut across there, because I remember when Peter was talking about this a few years ago, you, Peter, and I don't know if this is going to come across now, you actually wanted to portray Brighton's underbelly, the crime aspect of it, the Knocker Boys and all that sort of thing. You know, so where are we at? Are we talking about sort of selling Brighton as a good place or selling Brighton as a, you know, a kind of Graham Greene type place?
Oh, I think a combination of the two, very definitely. I think that, you know, Brighton, it would be daft to portray Brighton as a sort of completely pure, beautiful city of no crime. But it's... what I love about Brighton, I think that what I genuinely feel is that the most vibrant cities in the world are the ones that do have a criminal underbelly. If you think about where in the world you'd like to go most, let's take America, New York, Chicago, you know, Los Angeles, Miami, you know, they've all got big criminal undertows. If you look at Australia, which are the really exciting cities there? It's Melbourne, and Sydney and Adelaide, you know, they've got these big criminal gangs. And I think that if you go around the world, it's the criminal undertow contrasts wonderfully with the beauty of the place.
Okay, and that is all we've got time for this week. So, of course, many thanks to Alan Wares. Thank you to Polly Bancroft, to Joe Bacon, and to Peter James. I've been Aidy Packham. This has been the Albion Raw on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and, of course, on the podcast. Thanks for listening, and hopefully we'll have better news next week.
comes to town.